Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, how much of New York's $2.5 billion opioid settlement money is making its way to the rural communities hit hardest by addiction? The state promises those funds will help, but right now, the impact remains a mystery. Reporter Kimberly Izar is digging into the dollars behind the crisis in the second episode of Health on the Margins, Radio Catskill's original investigative series uncovering what's really happening inside the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania's fragile healthcare systems. Community members came together yesterday for a caravan and vigil to stand with our immigrant neighbors. Reporter Genevieve Hartnett was there. And as folks look for new spaces to connect, the Northern Wayne Community Library is stepping up with services far beyond book lending. And grab your blue suede shoes, All Shook Up is at Liberty High School.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former Speaker of the House and California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi is announcing she won't seek re-election. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, her departure will mark the end of an era in Congress.
First elected in 1987, Pelosi would go on to become one of the most effective leaders of the Democratic Party. She cemented her place in the history books in 2007 when she was elected to become the first woman to serve as Speaker of the House. She could reliably deliver Democratic votes on must-pass legislation when necessary, although her first speakership came at a complicated time with a looming financial crisis. She reclaimed the gavel in 2019. During her 10 years as Speaker, she oversaw the passage of landmark legislation, including the Affordable Care Act, and enacted trillions in new spending as part of the American Rescue Plan. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate is about to take a vote on a bipartisan resolution that would block President Trump from engaging in military action in Venezuela. Trump has said he's considering it. The vote comes as Trump administration officials briefed a bipartisan group of top congressional leaders on deadly U.S. military attacks on vessels in the Eastern Pacific and the Caribbean. Trump says it's to stop drug trafficking. House Speaker Mike Johnson supports the action.
We have exquisite intelligence about these strikes on these vessels. We know the contents of the boats. We know the personnel, almost to a person.
But Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner says suspected drug traffickers should be arrested and put on trial.
Bringing these individuals before a court of law and showing the world, frankly, the drugs that were interdicted, sure as heck makes a lot of sense to me.
A previous Senate vote to limit Trump's war powers has failed. The federal government is reducing air traffic because of the government shutdown. Beginning tomorrow, the government will start to cut 10% of air traffic in 40 of the busiest markets. Stocks opened lower this morning after an ominous report on job cuts. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped nearly 300 points in early trading.
It was the worst October for layoff announcements in more than two decades. That's according to a monthly tally kept by Challenger Gray and Christmas, which helps companies manage job cuts. U.S. employers announced plans to cut more than 150,000 jobs in October. Tech companies and warehousing firms saw some of the biggest downsizing. Reports like Challenger's are getting extra scrutiny these days because official government reports on the job market have been suspended by the federal shutdown. Tesla investors are voting today on a proposed pay package that could reward CEO Elon Musk with up to $1 trillion in stock. The vote comes as part of Tesla's annual meeting in Austin, Texas. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. Kentucky officials have increased the death toll to 12 people from Tuesday's UPS cargo plane crash in Louisville. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshears declared a state of emergency and mobilized the National Guard. The U.S. Travel Association says the number of international tourists visiting the United States is down overall, but there is one area of growth, visitors from Mexico. From member station KTEP, Angela Cocherga has more.
New requirements and much higher fees for visitor visas don't seem to be stopping travelers from Mexico. According to federal data, arrivals by air are up slightly, and entry by cars grew by more than 13% this year. Texas and other border states depend on those visitors. At the outlet shops of El Paso, 65% of shoppers on weekends are from Mexico, says Gina Selecta, director of marketing for this mall and another one on the border in Laredo.
It is not unusual for us to see people come into the shopping center from Mexico with many family members and friends that have traveled together. They've come here in their big SUVs.
Along with shopping, visitors from Mexico spend money on shows in Las Vegas and amusement parks. For NPR News, I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
Typhoon Kalmagi has made landfall on the coast of central Vietnam. The Joint Typhoon Warning Center says its top sustained winds are more than 120 miles per hour. The typhoon hit the Philippines first, where it killed at least 114 people. The Philippines remains under a state of emergency. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Total Wine and More, offering a variety of beverages for gatherings and crisp fall nights. More at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York has secured over $2.5 billion in opioid settlement funds to date that it says will be distributed to local governments over the next 18 years. But how much of those dollars have actually improved rural communities most affected by the opioid overdose crisis? Well, that remains relatively unknown. This week, we debuted the second episode of Health on the Margins, diving into opioid settlement dollars. Health on the Margins is Radio Catskill's original investigative series about the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania's fragile healthcare systems. Here's Kimberly Izar with episode two.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar. A note for our listeners, this episode discusses substance use and addiction and may be difficult to listen to. It's 1996. Nintendo 64 debuted its video games in America. Bill Clinton was reelected president of the United States. And the pharmaceutical giant Purdue Pharma released OxyContin. It's a powerful opioid prescribed to treat persistent and severe pain. And it's around this time that health experts said the opioid crisis began. After Purdue Pharma released OxyContin, it aggressively marketed to care providers. In just 4 years, its sales grew from $48 million in 1996 to almost $1.1 billion in 2000. In 1998, the company made this video and distributed 15,000 copies to physicians without FDA approval. They asked doctors to show it to patients.
Once you've found the right doctor and have told him or her about your pain, don't be afraid to take what they give you. Often, it will be an opioid medication. Some patients may be afraid of taking opioids because they're perceived as too strong or addictive. But that is far from actual fact. Less than 1% of patients taking opioids actually become addicted. And any drowsiness that might occur when you start to take the medication will soon wear off in most patients.
The marketing video is not only misleading, it's also not true. As many as one in four people receiving prescription opioids long-term in a primary care setting struggles with opioid addiction, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. Over the last two decades, the number of opioid-related overdoses has skyrocketed. More than 5,000 New Yorkers died from an opioid overdose in 2023, according to State Health Department data. And by 2021, lawmakers, families, and health advocates had enough. New York State enacted legislation to create a dedicated opioid settlement fund to address the opioid crisis. Opioid settlement funds is money that states secured from lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies for their role in fueling the opioid epidemic. And for New York, they've secured over $2.5 billion in opioid settlement dollars to date that the state says they'll distribute over the next 18 years. So, where is the money?
There's a bunch of money, I think, sitting unspent. And I'm worried about that being stolen, to be honest, by the state for other purposes.
From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Health on the Margins, a series that looks at the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania's fragile healthcare deserts. Over the past few decades, the number of healthcare providers has declined. Community hospitals have closed, and access to what is available is getting further and further from home. Health on the Margins digs into how we got here and where our rural region may head next. This is episode 2 of our series, and today we're looking at opioid settlement funds. I'm Kimberly Izar. So if you haven't already listened to the first episode on the state of the opioid crisis, I really recommend that you start there. It gives some important information for this episode. You can find Health on the Margins on our website at wjffradio.org. When I was reporting on that episode, a lot of people were both excited and worried about opioid settlement funds because, well, it's a lot of money.
Starting today, and for the next month, I will be traveling our state spreading the good news that we are delivering as much as $1.5 billion to New Yorkers.
That's Attorney General Letitia James back in 2021 in North Country after her office filed the state's most extensive opioid settlement lawsuit against manufacturers, distributors, and the Sackler family who own Purdue Pharma.
And it's not over. As you know, we've got a trial in Suffolk County with two remaining defendants. So the trial is continuing, but also we are continuing having settlement discussions with those two defendants, and hopefully we'll bring you some more money.
And she was right. More money kept coming to New York State under the promise that those funds would repair the damage of the opioid crisis in the communities most harmed. But does the money actually go where it should? Well, in New York, it's not so simple to find out. Here's the thing. If you wanted to quickly find something simple, let's say a list of all the treatment centers in the Catskills that's received money, well, you'll have to do a lot of digging. Once New York State's Office of Addiction Services and Supports, or OASIS, distributes to local counties, they have minimal oversight on how it's spent. There's an annual report that counties need to submit to the state, but there's really no standard format. For instance, Sullivan County's report lists all contracts listed with exact amounts, but Orange County's report, for example, is much less detailed. I recently spoke with Rob Kent, who is a substance use expert, to help me understand how money exactly moves in New York. He was the former general counsel for the Biden administration's White House of National Drug Control Policy, and before that, he was general counsel for OASIS. Kent is one of several people Radio Catskill spoke to who criticized New York State for being too slow to move the money and keep track of where it's going. Rob, what kind of oversight does OASIS have exactly?
Not much. I mean, the state legislature has started to look at whether they should have not necessarily oversight, but more information coming from the local governments. There were some articles written in Newsday in Long Island about how the two counties in Long Island, Nassau, Suffolk, had spent very little of their money. And a lot was sitting in the bank earning interest, which the government was using likely for other purposes. So OASIS, the state can't tell the counties how to spend their money, which is a real problem, by the way, because that's what leads you into following the same bad path that the tobacco settlements followed, which is most of the money was not used for you know, its intended purpose. And so, yeah, local governments are supposed to report information. I think they're going to be asked to report more information. But in terms of OASIS saying you shouldn't be spending the money on this or that, they don't have that authority in the law.
Radio Catskill reached out to our New York listening area's health departments in Sullivan, Orange, and Ulster counties to learn how they spent their funds. Sullivan and Ulster counties shared their 2024 spending totals, but Orange County did not respond to our questions before this episode aired. Even with Sullivan and Ulster counties, it took some back and forth to get the information. And in Sullivan County, treatment programs for people with substance use issues still made up the smallest share of spending in 2024 compared to law enforcement and prevention efforts. In October, New York earned $35 million in interest from opioid settlement dollars just sitting.
There is money sitting unspent, and no one can tell me the need is not there. It absolutely is there.
Are there any time-bound restrictions with these funds at the state level or at the county level?
No. I mean, that basically at the state level, money comes into the state it has to be appropriated in the budget process, which it has been. And if it's not spent in that fiscal year, usually what they do is reappropriate it for future use. Right. And that's where I noticed, I mean, when I looked at budget bills in the last number of years, how much money was being reappropriated, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
The disparities depending on where you live are astronomical. Even though they're only about an hour apart, Sullivan County prescribed opioids at nearly three times the rate of Rockland County in 2023. Sullivan County has the third highest per capita opioid overdose deaths in New York State.
It seems to have been lost on folks that the government's really the fiduciary of.
This is a test of the Sullivan County Emergency Alert System. In the event of an actual emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test of the Emergency Alert System is now concluded.
We learned that you cannot get money to communities unless community is at the table and has a not just a recommendation role, but has a role of power. So in HIV, we got money out through what was called community planning. And that meant that government and community was at the table. They had to agree, look at the data, not what you believe where the money should go, follow the data with the money, and then agree that that is the way the money is going to go out the door. And if there's not agreement, government doesn't get the money to put out the door.
And for funds that have gone out the door, some have criticized local counties for not using the funds to its full potential. For instance, all unrestricted dollars in 2024, roughly $37,000 in Sullivan County, went to law enforcement. Gardner also says that how funds are being distributed isn't happening equitably.
This is happening across the country, that we're seeing numbers diminishing in terms of overdose deaths. It's just not happening equally or uniformly, right?
While overdose deaths among white people have fallen, for Black, Latino, and Indigenous people, overdose death rates have skyrocketed nationwide.
Black people in rural settings are at particular risk for overdose deaths. And Black communities in what I call the suburban urbans, but basically the big cities outside of New York City are also, their Black communities are also not experiencing the same level of decline in deaths.
Black New Yorkers are less likely to have access to treatment care and life-saving measures like Narcan, and more likely to be criminalized for drug-related offenses. Gardner says anti-Black racism was embedded in fueling the opioid crisis from the beginning.
The anti-Blackness that's built in to these systems, I feel, informed even the beginning of the prescription pill crisis, because these doctors were saying to people, you won't get addicted like those people. You can take these pills. You're not going to get addicted. And that is in the heads of people, that they so associate Black and brown people with addiction, that that was easily embraced rather than the science of the addictive nature of opioids.
Gardner is also a board member for the state's Opioid Settlement Fund Advisory Board. But while she sits on the advisory board, she says she's limited on what she can do. That's because the advisory board can only recommend to OASIS how dollars are spent based on research and evidence.
We cannot force the agency that administers the dollars, Office of Addiction Support Services, we can't compel them. And so to me, it's because the lawyers who negotiated the settlements and agreed or made agreements with the the manufacturers about how the money would go out. It was constructed like tobacco settlement versus constructed like community planning dollars.
That's increasingly becoming a problem as billions of dollars in federal funding for housing, healthcare, and other services disappear. In July, opioid advisory board members and OASIS clashed over how to respond to a looming threat. Would New York use opioid settlement money to make up for federal aid instead of its intended purpose? Advisory board members urged OASIS to cut the red tape and get the money out quickly. Rob Kent agrees.
And I'm afraid that states will look to steal, because that's what I'm just going to call it. It's a flat out steal, opioid settlement funds to cover losses that have nothing to do with opioid abatement.
So what states are doing it well? Coming up, we're heading south, all the way down from the Catskills to North Carolina. We wanted to talk to other states to learn how they've managed their opioid settlement funds. North Carolina has been touted as a model for making it as transparent as possible to see where money flows. So, how'd they do it? That's right after this break.
Radio Catskill depends on donations from our listeners, including donations from our listeners' music collections. People donate their music collections to us, we sell them to the next generation of music fans, and that keeps the station on air. Records, CDs, stereo equipment, and more. It comes from the community and goes back to the community, so Radio Catskill can stay on the air for the community. Donate your music collection today. Email feedback at wjffradio.org.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Thanks for sticking with us.
It's Layla Faldin. Thank you for having our back.
It's A. Martinez. Thank you for staying informed with us.
It's Michelle Martin. Thank you for trusting us.
Thank you for supporting this station.
Thank you for supporting this station.
Thank you for supporting this station.
We'll get through this together.
Support Radio Catskill at wjffradio.org. Thanks.
We're back with Health on the Margins. I'm Kimberly Izar. If you're just joining us, we've been looking at the barriers New York State has to get opioid settlement dollars out the door. And we're about to head to North Carolina, which has been touted as a model for making it as easy as possible to know where opioid settlement funds are going. North Carolina is expected to receive $750 million over the next 18 years in opioid settlement dollars. That's less than a quarter of what New York State has secured so far. But there's a big difference between the two states. For North Carolina, you can go to the state's opioid settlement tracker and see how each local government is spending the money. You can't do that for New York.
There's 100 counties in North Carolina, and we all have individual challenges, but a lot of our challenges are the same. And so, you know, if I'm feeling a little stuck in a certain area or not really sure, I can pull up the Core and See website and go to another county and see how they've decided to spend their funds. You know, maybe a county of a similar size or similar, demographic. And I can see what's happening in Alamance County. I can see what's happening in Wake County. I can see what's happening in Edgecombe County. So, I mean, it just feels like statewide, there's a true collaboration and partnership.
That's Tia Fowler. She's the assistant county manager and opioid settlement manager for Nash County in North Carolina. Like Sullivan County in New York, Nash County in North Carolina is a smaller rural area of the state. Both counties have a similar population size, with both counties having about 80 to 100,000 residents. And both say substance use stigma still remains a big hurdle to seeking treatment.
Stigma is a huge barrier to treatment. In a small community, people care what other people think. You know what I mean? Everyone kind of knows everyone. And so overcoming stigma is a big thing in smaller communities. In all communities, but definitely in smaller communities where everybody really knows their neighbor.
Fella says Nash County did something different when planning for the future. They asked communities directly how to use the money before any money was even allocated. They hosted community town halls at five locations to hear directly from people most affected by the opioid crisis.
The strategies that we have started with are a direct response to the feedback from our community, but also aligns with the options available in our memorandum of agreement. And so after compiling all of this information, we were able to get some just really consistent feedback from our community members. There's definitely a need for treatment. There are not a lot of treatment providers in our community. There's definitely a need for early intervention. One of the more passionate parts of our community conversation is when community members are talking about how early children are exposed and using drugs in our school systems. And this isn't unique to Nash County. This is really nationwide.
She says that extra step involving the community resulted in subtle yet big ways for how dollars are distributed. For example, both Nash County in North Carolina and Sullivan County in New York have some form of an emergency overdose response team. But Sullivan County's money goes to the local police department, and Nash County's money goes to community ambulance providers. Of course, each community and state are different, but it poses a larger question of, are these dollars being dictated by what the community says they need?
What's making them be received so well is that people are feeling that their local government cares, right? There's like feeling behind it. They can feel that we're listening. They can feel that we care. And in a time where I think people are often frustrated with their local government, this gives an opportunity for them to really see their wishes, their needs in action. And that's something that I'm really excited about.
Fowler says that she's hopeful that other states like New York can learn from North Carolina's approach to transparency and community planning. While Nash County is still in its early stages of implementation, she's hopeful that the state's collaborative nature will benefit communities most affected by the opioid crisis.
It feels like just an overall effort to make sure that the communities are better off than when we started. And so I feel like I have a lot of support from our community. I feel like I have a lot of support from our commissioners. It just really feels like we're not in this alone. It can feel overwhelming to try to solve, you know, an opioid crisis in your community. You know, sometimes you need to talk to some partners to help to resolve issues, but I really do feel like we have the resources and the partnership for all local governments in North Carolina to be successful.
Next time on Health on the Margins, we look at women's and reproductive health care in the region. In 2020, the only Planned Parenthood in Sullivan County closed. The next nearest Planned Parenthood clinic in Goshen closed 4 years later, along with three other upstate locations. So where do people go for reproductive health care services in our region? That's next time on Health on the Margins. If you or someone you know needs help, you can find treatment and support at findtreatment.gov. You can also call the 988 Lifeline at 988 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if you need someone to talk to. Health on the Margins is hosted, reported, and produced by me, Kimberly Izar, with contributed reporting by Julia Kim and Patricio Raballo. Editorial support by Tim Bruno, Jason Dole, Ronald Kelson, Patricio Raballo, and Genevieve Hardnett. The music in this episode is from Lexin_music from Pixabay. If you enjoyed the show, let us know by leaving us a comment wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find that podcast on our website and the previous episode of Health on the Margins. Go to wjffradio.org, click on shows on the navigation bar, and then in the drop-down menu, select podcasts. You'll find it right there. And you can hear all of Kim's great reporting, plus all of our podcasts, wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Rural and Migrant Ministry held a caravan and vigil in South Fallsburg and Monticello yesterday, standing with immigrant neighbors and calling for fairness, due process, and recognition of their contributions. Our own Genevieve Hartnett was there and has a report next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we talk comfort food from around the world with the beloved Yotam Ottolenghi. And we learn about classic German cooking with the wonderful Louisa Weiss. That's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's big annual music sale returns November 29th, the Saturday after Thanksgiving. With vinyl records, cassettes, CDs, stereo equipment, musical instruments, and more, we're still accepting donations. If you're a collector who can part with any high-quality or rare vinyl, we'd love to hear from you. Email feedback@wjffradio.org or just come to the big music sale, 10 to 3, November 29th at the Liberty Mall.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Community members came together Wednesday for a caravan and vigil organized by Rural and Migrant Ministry. They were standing with immigrant neighbors and interfaith leaders, local officials, and allies joined in calling for fairness, due process, and celebrating the contributions of immigrants. Genevieve Hartnett was there and has this audio postcard.
It's a windy day in South Fallsburg, New York, and people are getting away from the cold in the upper room at the Spark Center, formerly St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. Large white poster boards and colorful markers are scattered all across tables, and people are making signs as they eat leftover Halloween candy. They're all here with Rural and Migrant Ministry, who are hosting a car caravan traveling from the Spark Center all the way to the Sullivan County Courthouse in Monticello for a vigil to stand in solidarity with immigrants. Today's event is mostly attended by allies and supporters, as many of the people Rural and Migrant Ministry works with feel intimidated by increased ICE profiling and raids. However, the supporters who are here today know their signs will be taped to their cars and seen all around Sullivan County, so they hope to make their voices heard.
Tell me your name.
My name is Annette Foy.
Hi, Annette. What's your sign?
My sign is something actually that one of the young fellas in my little youth group said to me one day, and at first I didn't catch it, and he had to get me to catch it. And he said to me, "Can I tell you a joke? I never knew an orange can be so sour." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he showed me a picture of someone. And I found it very funny.
Racking up nearly 20 cars with flashers on traveling down Route 42, the caravan certainly elicited reactions, with equal amounts of honked horns and supportive cheers, as there were middle fingers and jeers along the way. Still, attendees were not just here for a parade. Angela Diuto, Catskill Regional Coordinator for Rural and Migrant Ministry, spoke about how even in times of division, she hoped this event would show how interconnected our struggles really are.
We have more in common than differences, and it's so important we remember and reflect that we're all immigrants, and we all have immigrant story, and it might be many generations back, but we do have that in common as a country of immigrants.
Once the group reached their destination at the courthouse, members of Rural and Migrant Ministry and other community members came to a podium to build community and talk about concrete steps they should be taking to protect vulnerable people. Sandra Oxford spoke of holding recently re-elected local leaders responsible for their role in unauthorized ICE raids.
So nice to see my friends, my family, and what has become my faith community. I live in the town of Fallsburg, where we started out. 70% of the children in the school district in the town of Fallsburg are Latino students. Many of their families work in food processing, in agriculture, and you know, driving past the police station is very important. Regrettably, many of the conversations that happen in county government here really look at immigrant people, look at brown people like a possibility to capitalize and maximize and have these dreaded contracts with the federal government in our empty jail. While Sullivan County is the fourth county in the state of New York out of 50 rural counties to send our youth to the State Department of Correction. And everyone here, not to be a Debbie Downer, so we're going to go in the other direction. We have spent so much time doing the opposite, celebrating each other, celebrating our diversity, coming out in defense of each other. And I just...
While Wilmer Jimenez, Chief Program Officer of Rural Migrant Ministry, spoke of upcoming state bills the community should mobilize in support of.
The Farm Workers Labor Practice Act that we continue to support, and we have a few Albany trips in the upcoming, the beginning of next year, so that's kind of like an extended invitation that would be.
But Rural and Migrant Ministry is also an organization rooted in faith-based community organizing. Executive Director Reverend Richard Witt spoke about how figures like Martin Luther King Jr. used worship and words to connect people and work towards social justice.
Social justice and faith to me are the same thing. In order to be faithful, we have to be committed to loving our neighbor. And to love your neighbor means to ensure that they are treated justly and that their dignity is honored.
And just like in a place of worship, the vigil was filled with poetry and song. G. Oliver King gave a stirring rendition of Langston Hughes's Let America Be America Again to show how far we've come and how far we still have to go.
Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America.
It may be the day after a historic election in New York and across the country, but the caravan and vigil showed that Rural and Migrant Ministry is only getting started in working to protect vulnerable communities.
Written by Woody Guthrie. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
In Monticello, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Genevieve, for that. There's more information about Rural Migrant Ministry at ruralmigrantministry.org. And a follow-up to the election results, did you vote on Proposition 1 in New York on the back of your ballot? Well, voters across New York narrowly approved Prop 1 on Tuesday. The ballot measure amends the state's constitution to retroactively allow ski trails and other development on the Adirondack Forest Preserve. It also protects thousands of acres in the park. According to unofficial election results, Prop 1 was approved by about 46% of voters, while more than 12% left their ballots blank. Emily Russell reports for the New York Public News Network.
With the approval of Proposition 1, the New York State Constitution will be amended to allow development at Mount Van Hovenberg Olympic Sports Complex in Lake Placid. The state-run site is managed by the Olympic Regional Development Authority. Years ago, ORDA violated the state's constitution when it cut down trees on part of the property that's on State Forest Preserve. A majority of voters in every North Country county approved Prop 1. The ballot measure wasn't as well received downstate, where it was rejected by a majority of voters in most counties in the New York City area. Voters in Manhattan narrowly approved the measure by a 1% margin. Now that Prop 1 has been approved, ORDA's management and any future development at Mount Van Hovenberg will be legal. Voters have approved similar amendments to allow state management at Whiteface and Gore Mountains. The passage of Prop 1 also approves a new land deal for the Adirondacks. The DEC is now required to add 2,500 acres of land to the Forest Preserve as a way to make amends for ORDA's past violations. The DEC says it's unclear where that new Forest Preserve land will be or how the state will pay for it. In the Adirondacks, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, what do robots, community programs, and lifelong learning have in common? You can find them all at the Northern Wayne Community Library, and maybe a few more surprises you didn't know were there. Library Director Amy Payne joins us next with more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flato here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I spotlight Lucy Joseph, back by popular demand after a sold-out run at Farm Arts Collective. Discover the true story of the 19th century gender non-conforming pioneer Lucy Ann Joseph Israel Lobdell. It is a tale of courage, identity, and living your truth. tune in to the full podcast dropping this Friday at WJFFradio.org. While we all sup sorrow
with the poor. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, if you think you know what a library is, think again. At the Northern Wayne Community Library, you'll find clubs, classes, digital tools, and plenty of ways to get involved, even outside regular hours. Joining us now is Library Director Amy Payne to talk about all the ways the library is supporting the Northern Wayne community. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So if I haven't visited your library in a while, what do you think would surprise me about your library today?
Well, libraries have something for everyone, not just our library. We have not only a diverse collection of books and ebooks, but we have many programs for all ages. Libraries are really becoming community hubs where people can gather for educational programs, social connections, and to find needed services. And we have some popular programs each month. We have our Second Saturday STEAM, which is a family-oriented science, technology, education, art, and math related program where they come and do usually an activity and we read a book. And it's really just to get, to make that family connection and to make a social connection with other families in the community. We also have our craft night every month, which is a social opportunity for adults to express their creative side. And we also have educational programs for adults, such as our community education service programs, which we invite a local expert to come and speak on a topic that the community is interested in. And since we're up here in the rural northern part of the county, our topics usually include programs on the lakes and rivers or the wildlife. We've had the Game Commission come and speak. We've had the Fish and Boat Commission come out. We also have health topics related to mental health and to aging. The local medical clinics come out and do programs for the senior citizens and for anybody else that has a topic that they're interested in. So we really try to touch on as many things as we can that the community has an interest in.
And you mentioned your location, the Northern Wayne Community Library, is in Lakewood. Talk about Lakewood in that area for folks who may not be familiar with it and how the community has responded to some of the things that you mentioned there beyond the books that you have. It's probably pretty vital being in such a rural area.
Yes, Northern Wayne Community Library is in Lakewood, PA, and we service four municipalities, local municipalities. We service, the whole county, but our main area is the four local municipalities around us. And we're rural, so there isn't too many social activities happening up here. So really the library has focused on providing activities for all ages, and the community is very grateful. We get a ton of support from the community. They help us keep our doors open by supporting, our annual campaign and all of our fundraisers that we do each year. So we provide for our community and they provide for us. So it's really a win-win situation and we support each other.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about that support from the community. How is the library funded?
Well, we're funded a few ways. We are a nonprofit organization. All the libraries in Wayne County are each an individual nonprofit organization. So that means that we're not tax-based. So the local municipalities don't pay, a library tax. We get about probably a third to maybe almost half of our budget from the state and the county monies that they give us each year. But again, it's not tax-based. So it's never guaranteed, how much we're going to get. And it's been stagnant for quite a few years. So really, the local libraries, including us, we rely heavily on our local donors and our local community members to really donate, donate the money to keep our doors open. So they understand how important we are. And we give back as much as we can in way of services and programs. So, yeah, we really support each other.
And do you have ways that folks can help support that you want to make sure folks know about?
Sure. Well, we are always having many different fundraisers during the year. Currently, we are having a fundraiser called December Giftaway, and that is a raffle ticket fundraiser where the ticket purchaser can win a prize each day in December. So we also rely on our local businesses to donate great prizes, whether that's through our December Giftaway raffle that's going on now, or we have bingos a few times a year. And our community businesses are also another huge supporter. Like, we couldn't do what we're doing without their support.
It really is about community. It's about the community of the libraries in Wayne County as well. You're part of the Wayne Library Alliance, the federated library system made up of the 7 autonomous public libraries in Wayne County. Talk about that alliance and how important it is for all of you.
Well, the Wayne Library Alliance is very important. Like you said, there's 7 of us independent libraries, and we all work together and we share resources, which is a huge help financially for all of us. We have some exciting things that are coming up that I think the community is going to be really excited about in a few weeks. And
Uh-oh, you're teasing us. Can you tell us more?
I'm teasing, yeah. You have to watch for a press release. But we're really working hard, you know, together, and we're really making some huge progress in keeping keeping the library strong.
Okay,
and
good.
Supporting the community. Yep.
Watch this space, Wayne County Public Library Alliance there. Talk a little bit about, and I mentioned this in the introduction, about how you can enjoy some of the services offered even outside of regular hours. How does that work?
Well, we have a website, which is waynelibraries.org, and you can go to the website with your library card number, and you can browse through the books, order the books you want, and then pick them up at your library. There's also electronic books through Libby, which you can basically browse through books and magazines from the comfort of your own home on either your phone or your computer, whatever type of device you have. So you can always find the resources when the library is closed. We also have programs that happen on, you know, not our normal library hours, like our craft night is once a month. So that happens from 6 to 8. Our paint and sip fundraiser is going on this Sunday from 2 o'clock. And other fundraisers are during Saturday hours. So we're open when we need to be in order to service the community, mm-hmm. you know, where they're at and at convenient times for them also.
Well, let's remind folks of the way to get in touch with you and how to find out about all the other libraries in the Alliance.
Well, you can go to the website to find more information. That's www.waynelibraries.org. You can also call any of the libraries to ask for any information that you need and any services that you might need.
And before we go, what's the one thing you wish people knew more about the library?
That we're just there for them. I think libraries are really underutilized by many people. We're free, so you can get free entertainment, whether that's reading books, movies. You can also get help connecting to different services or to get technology help for free. So the library staff is really there to support you. So if you need something, you know, you can come in and we'll try to help you. We're there for the community all the time.
Yeah, sometimes libraries get taken for granted, but they are right there and pillars of the community. Amy Payne is the director of the Northern Wayne Community Library there in Lakewood in Wayne County. Amy, thanks for being with us. And you know, no chance you're going to break some news here with that information you were teasing
right now? You just have to wait a few weeks.
All right, I tried. All right, Amy. Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Bye.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, some Elvis energy is hitting Liberty this weekend. We got a sneak peek after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
The need is growing. More families in our community are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are on the front lines, but they need help. You can make a difference by donating non-perishable food, personal care items, and baby supplies, or by volunteering to support and distribute these donations. It's about nourishing our neighbors. Visit WJFFradio.org for info to help ensure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Get ready to rock and roll in Liberty. The Liberty Performing Arts Drama Club is bringing the high-energy jukebox musical All Shook Up to the high school stage. It's where one Elvis-style rebel arrives and turns a sleepy 1950s town on its head. Shows are tomorrow and Saturday in the Liberty High School auditorium. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with co-director Emily McConnell to find out just how wild things get when the music starts.
Good morning and welcome to Radio Catskill. Today, our guest is Emily McConnell, and she is the director of the Liberty Drama Club's production of All Shook Up, and she's here to tell us about it. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I'm going to say you probably have your hands full.
Yeah, it's a big production we're putting on this weekend.
Yeah, and it's coming up soon.
Yes, we're in our rehearsal tech week this week, and costumes are ready in the hallway, and the mics are on, and the kids are really excited.
That's great. Tell us a little bit about how that particular musical was chosen.
Actually, we originally decided on a different musical, and as the directors were getting kind of talking, we decided we didn't quite have the cast that we needed for the other production. And we kind of put our heads together and said, what would be a fun show, but also a new show? And we came up with All Shook Up. And I think people will really enjoy it because they will know the songs of Elvis. But it's also set to the roughly based on the Twelfth Night by Shakespeare. So we have a whole bunch of love triangles and funny lines that happen, but it's all set to Elvis music. And the kids are doing a really great job with all of the love triangles and all of the confusing scenes, and I think the audience will get a kick out of it.
And you must have some good performers.
Absolutely. Our leads are top-notch. Between Jacob Kelly and Eli DeRocher and Cassandra Porter, Gabriella Sheridan and Leah Guillaume, they are totally killing these roles and the songs. Bring tissues for several of these powerhouse songs because you're going to have goosebumps or cry. And then you're definitely going to tap your toe, and the dancing is coming along, and there's just a lot of high energy for this.
Now, this play originated in the early 2000s, I believe.
Yeah, it's a newer musical. I think the release was 2004. And it's what's called a jukebox musical.
What is a jukebox musical?
That's where pre-recorded, pre-written music is taken and put into the plot line of a story. There's several Broadway performances that are doing that right now, Moulin Rouge and Juliet. So like they are using other pop songs and putting it into the storyline, and that's what they've done with All Shook Up. They've used all of Elvis's hits and made it so that it fits into the story that happens.
I'm assuming the kids are having a wild time with Elvis.
Yeah, it's great. And so actually there is no Elvis character.
But Elvis-like character.
Yeah, and it's very much like Footloose, where, you know, a rebel comes to town into a conservative town and kind of shakes things up a little bit. So there's that fun aspect of this very serious and conservative side, but also this, like, let's party and have a great time and enjoy music and dancing, too.
And how many directors do you have?
I'm co-directing with a parent who's been extraordinary. His name is John Giffen Tenner. And then we have a music director, a choreographer, a lighting design specialist, and a sound design specialist. And then I have two adults helping me backstage managing the stage crew.
That all requires a fairly big commitment of time and energy.
Yes, from adults and students.
Yeah. And what's the age range?
It is a high school production. We have included several middle schoolers, 7th and 8th grade, because we are a growing program, and they just started a musical last year in the middle school. So we've kind of grandfathered in some of those kids who were with us previously. So we do have 7 through 12 in the cast.
And what was that musical?
They did Shrek last year.
That's right. That sounds very familiar. So you must be very excited.
Yes, absolutely.
You must have quite a history there at Liberty Performing Arts.
Yes, I do. This is my 16th musical.
And what is your training?
I am a musician. I'm the high school music teacher. I was in the middle school for 12 years and moved up to the high school. I play piano as my main instrument, and I sing. And I performed in musical theater starting in 7th grade all the way up through high school. And then I, in college, did a lot of accompanying for shows.
Where did you go to college?
SUNY Fredonia.
Oh, wow. How nice. I have friends that went there many moons ago.
It's a great school.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude?
Just come and see the show. Let's support the kids and have a full house, and you're going to have a good evening out.
Okay, and let's give that information I have here. The tickets can be purchased at ticketsource.com/liberty-performing-arts.
That's correct. And at the door as well.
And at the door. Okay.
Yes.
Well, have fun.
Okay, thank you.
You are welcome.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that conversation. Again, All Shook Up at Liberty High School is coming up tomorrow and Saturday. We've got a little bit of time, so let's go out with the 2005 production of All Shook Up from Broadway. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA.
As I say, the hunting of Latinos.
If there's anything you should hear to get a full picture, not only of what's going on with the ICE raids, but what's to come, it's this.
It's exhausting, but I would be more tired and more exhausted if the community was left unprotected.
That's this week on Latino USA. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill Local News, Culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, a breezy, cooler with some clouds, maybe breaking for some sun this afternoon. High 41, clear this evening, and then some clouds moving in overnight. Low 27. Tomorrow's high 49 with a shower possible in the evening. Cloudy on Saturday, 53. Sunday's high 46. And then some cold air moving in early next week, the coldest of the season. The low on Monday, 25. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.